Marco E. Torres Jr. Mr. Pickens, good morning to you.
Good morning. My name is Jeff Pickens. I'm co-counsel with the Commission on Public Advocacy. I'm a little bit confused how to handle this because I have somebody with me today. Her name is There you go. Hannah Carol Altman, and she's doing an externship at in our office this semester, and she helped me with this project. She is senior certified, and I understand she argued either in this case or in the Court of Appeals, in case, I think it was a Court of Appeals case that was decided, it was last Tuesday. This is an appeal from an order denying post-conviction relief. Torres' post-conviction motion was primarily based on Hearst versus Florida. In Hearst, the U.S. Supreme Court held that the Sixth Amendment requires a jury to find each fact necessary to impose a sentence of death. Additionally, the 14th Amendment requires that these facts be considered elements that have to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and the jury has to be unanimous. The U.S. Supreme Court in Hearst, though, left two unresolved issues, and that one is, does the holding in Hearst go beyond just the jury finding aggravating circumstances, or does it need to find additional facts? Of course, you know, in Ring, the court held that the jury only had to find aggravating circumstances. The other unresolved issue, of course, is whether Hearst applies retroactively. And it's my understanding that the Hearst retroactivity has not been argued to this court yet. I guess at this time I would tell you that I don't think that you ought to get to the merits of that issue in this case or in any other cases. With respect to retroactivity, I believe you ought to wait for the U.S. Supreme Court to decide that. This court has, I think, a mixed record on deciding when cases are retroactive. And, of course, those are all tough cases. In Miller, you got it right. In Padilla, you didn't. So I think it would be in the best interest if you did not consider the retroactivity yet and just wait for the U.S. Supreme Court to decide that.
How do we get past the one-year statute of limitations?
Well, that's a great question.
To get to that issue.
Yeah, and that is, that's the, I guess I wanted to start with the second assignment of error. That's the State versus Amaya Dea versus McDonough issue. And I do think that this court ought to overrule Amaya, or at least modify it so that you look at the entire holding in Day. Day was first cited in Crawford, and then it was cited in Amaya, and this court cited the proposition that the court on its own can consider the statute of limitations issue without giving notice and an opportunity to be heard. Clearly, this court needs to include the other elements of that decision.
Well, when a statute of limitations problem is reasonably apparent, can't the person who's filing the post-conviction motion deal with it in the motion?
Yes, and that's how this court handles successive motions. And I hope to get a lot of argument before I got that question. Because, yeah, that's certainly one way that you could handle this, is by requiring litigants to affirmatively show in their post-conviction motion
I'm not saying that's required as a condition of filing a motion for post-conviction relief, but I guess I am taking a little bit of quarrel with your premise about due process, that they didn't have an opportunity. They do have an opportunity. They may choose not to use it, but that's their problem, isn't it?
Well, this court has never required them to make that kind of a showing. Clearly, in a successive motion case, this court has been very clear that you have to make that showing. And I wouldn't have any sympathy for someone who didn't explain why they're not procedurally barred from bringing this motion. But to this point, you haven't required that. And I don't know if that will be the outcome of this case. But I guess the question I would ask, I've never practiced in civil court, But there is a statute of limitations in civil court, in most cases probably, and if the plaintiff filed a motion, would it be appropriate for the trial judge to dismiss that motion on his or her own without giving notice?
Is it commonly an affirmative defense?
Pardon me?
Is it commonly an affirmative defense in the civil cases?
Well, like I said, I don't practice in civil court, but I think so. But
what's the analogous civil equivalent to the preliminary review that the post-conviction statute contemplates?
Right, and you've got me there.
Okay.
And I don't have a good response to that. But my point was, would a court in a civil case automatically rule in favor of the defendant without giving notice to anybody and without having a hearing? And I suspect that probably would not happen. But when you look at Day versus McDonough, clearly there should be a requirement to give notice and an opportunity to be heard. And then with respect to the statute of limitations, yeah, if you look at the various motions in this case and the various orders, it certainly appears that the one year has run from the decision in Johnson and the decision in Hearst. But in McDonough, the U.S. Supreme Court said that a court ought to consider whether it's in the best interest of justice to address the merits or to go ahead and dismiss the case. So that's what I'm hanging my hat on.
They made that decision in the context of federal habeas, didn't they?
That's right.
And that's a rather radically different statutory framework than our post-conviction statute.
Well, there are a lot of similarities, and this court has gone back and forth on when it will find federal habeas courts as instructive and not. Back in the 60s, when we first had our post-conviction statute, the first Supreme Court to decide the issue said this is different than federal habeas, and we're not going to rely on that. This is a totally different procedure. But in Amaya, this court found that the decision in Day was instructive. And so I wonder why you just pick out parts of it and not include the whole test that's in Day. It seems like that would be the appropriate thing to do.
In Day, did the state waive the statute of limitations issue?
No. What happened in Day is the government, the state, miscalculated the time.
So that was it.
So it didn't raise the issue.
It didn't raise it because of the miscalculation, mathematical.
Right. So the state thought that everything was just fine, and the judge brought to the attention of the parties that things weren't fine and there was a miscalculation. It appears that the one-year time period has run. But there was another case that's cited in my brief where the state, I think it was Colorado, intended to waive the statute of limitations because it wanted the court to get to the merits. And if I remember that case correctly, the federal district judge denied or dismissed on his own based upon statute of limitations. If I remember correctly, that case was reversed because the judge should have given the parties notice and an opportunity to be heard. Now, there are at least a handful of cases that are going to be in front of this court on the Hearst issue. And there may be other cases that are more appropriate. There may be cases where it's clear that they're still within the one-year time period. But I think this is a case where the court could consider, a trial court could consider, that the best interest of justice would be for the court to not dismiss the case based on the statute of limitations and go ahead and get to the merits. This is going to be litigated in federal court as well. You know, there are a lot of post-conviction motions being filed in death penalty cases.
Counsel, before you move off the sua sponte procedure topic and onto a different one, I didn't understand your argument to be that the claim was not time-barred. I understood your argument to be that the process was somehow defective. Is that right?
I think the process that's set out in Amaya, if it's not defective, it clearly is not consistent with Day. And so I think that the process should be consistent with Day.
Separate and apart from the process, are you claiming there is any basis on which your client's post-conviction motion is not time-barred? Are you saying it's not time-barred, and if so, based on what?
If I just look at the documents, it appears to me that it is time-barred. But I don't know this case. As you might know from looking at my motions to extend, I have a conflict of interest. Our office has a conflict of interest with Mr. Torres. I have not communicated with him. I'm communicating with his federal lawyers, and they got a waiver of conflict from him, a written waiver, to allow me to do this particular appeal. So I don't know if there's something in Mr. Torres' case that would prevent the clock from running. But we still have that issue about the interest of justice. And I don't know if there are any facts in Mr. Torres' case that could be presented to the district court to convince the district court that the interests of justice require that the merits be addressed rather than dismissing on the basis of statute of limitations.
And there is not an interest of justice exception to our statutory time limitation.
No, there is not.
The legislature hasn't added that.
No, and I don't think that's in 2254 either, the federal habeas for state convictions. Although I understand in, I'm trying to think of the name of the case where, if there are any questions, I would ask you to reverse the district court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Smith, good morning to you.
May it please the court, James D. Smith, appearing for the state of Nebraska, the appellee. The district court denied post-conviction relief for basic reason, and the basic reason is that Torres's post-conviction motion is time-barred by the one-year period of limitations. District court's reason is correct. District court should be affirmed. His substantive procedural arguments don't overcome the plain language of the Post-Conviction Act's one-year limitation period. This court's required to uphold the statute. The court doesn't have authority to amend the statute or to insert interest of justice exceptions when the legislature never put such language in the post-conviction limitation period. And frankly, the analysis can and should end there, because Judge Livingston, just the last paragraph of his order's analysis is right on point, that the cases on which Torres relies upon for saying new constitutional rule retroactivity, all of those are over 1 year old as of the time of the filing of the post-conviction motion, so it's time barred.
So you're at the end of the day, it's on the face of the motion. It looks time-barred.
On the face of the motion as a matter of law. The court doesn't have to do anything more than just look at its own opinions.
And not venture into the significance of Hearst and so forth, even if it was announcing a new principle and so forth.
Even if one assumes for purposes
retroactive.
Of argument it was establishing a new rule that was retroactive, it still was issued beyond the one-year time bar. So even if what they want to argue is Hearst is a new rule that's retroactive, I would strongly disagree with, it's still time barred.
What's your position with respect to subparagraph C, 2930014C, the impediment portion of the statute of limitations? How will a trial court typically know whether that is one of the triggering events from looking at the face of even a successive petition?
Well, first of all, he's not raising that argument anyhow. As far as an impediment created by state action, it would have to be something that the state affirmatively did to prevent the person from being able to file their post-conviction motion in a timely manner. He makes no such claims in his post-conviction motion at all that the state did anything to prevent him from filing it. So again, I think you can look at the face of it and see its time bar.
So it's the silence on the face of the successive petition that you think is important?
I think it's important, at least if he's seeking post-conviction relief that's otherwise time barred, he's got to allege some facts, some reason as to why it's not.
So building on Judge Castle's question then, the state would argue in favor of a rule that requires defendants to affirmatively state an impediment if one exists?
If they're claiming that the there's an impediment, yes, I would say that the inmate needs to make some type of an allegation. And in federal law, at least I do a lot of federal habeas, you typically will see something like that in which there's some allegation of an impediment that somehow or other prevented the timely filing.
And factually, that's what we had in Amaya, wasn't it? An allegation in the petition itself of an impediment.
I don't recall to that detail. But in federal law, you have something that's not even, we don't have in Nebraska, in federal habeas. The government could raise the statute of limitations for the first time on appeal. Nebraska law, that's certainly not the case, that the state wanted to claim that, the state has to do so. In this case, since it was clearly time-barred, the judge, and the reason the judge gave, frankly, is correct. He doesn't argue to the contrary. When I'm hearing this argument, I didn't hear the impediment mentioned in his brief, in his oral argument at all. One final thing. In my brief, at least the part where he's arguing the plain error claim as far as the 1A aggravator, and he's saying that the Supreme Court essentially was incorrect in finding the 1A aggravator on prior conviction because it wasn't actually alleged by the prosecution. I don't think you have to go any further than look at this court's direct appeal opinion, in which in Torres at page 176, you said the failure of a finding does not mean failure of the entire aggravator. The 1A aggravator is in the alternative, which is the prior conviction, or a person has a substantial prior history of serious assaultive or terrorizing activity. District court did find the aggravator existed. It did find the alternative of the substantial prior history. This court found the alternative of the substantial prior history. Prior aggravator thus was properly found or concluded. The alternative finding of a prior conviction, even if that was not accurate, dictum, whatever you want to call it, failure of that finding doesn't mean the entire aggravator failed. So that part of his argument, that's just an additional reason as to why his argument on the aggravator finding being plain error, it simply doesn't hold up. If the court has other questions, ask the district court be affirmed.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on.